What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You would like that?
Intensely. But wouldn't that drive you out of Reagan? It would bring us together. You and Reagan. You and us.
Josh, you may want to gargle with a little holy water before we get this show started. You don't sound so good.
I'm not Josh.
This week on Film Spotting, my demonic co-host and I get in the Halloween spirit with a sacred cow review of 1973's The Exorcist. William Friedkin's horror classic turns 40 this year. We'll also revisit our terrifying characters top five from last fall and continue our look at contemporary Korean cinema with 2008's The Chaser. That and more.
Now kindly undo these straps.
After the show, Josh, after the show, ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM10.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. Our top five this week, in honor of Halloween, terrifying characters. We're revisiting that top five from 2012. Michael Phillips will help us out with that one. That's coming later in the show.
Legend has it that in 1973, William Friedkin's The Exorcist caused an audience member or two to actually faint. Take a deep breath, Adam. We'll have none of that here.
Is there someone inside you?
Sometimes.
Who is it?
I don't know.
Is it Captain Howdy?
I don't know.
If I ask him to tell me, will you let him answer?
No.
Why not?
I'm afraid.
If he talks to me, I think he'll leave you. Do you want him to leave you?
Yes.
I'm speaking to the person inside of Reagan now. If you are there, you too are hypnotized. I must answer all my questions. Come forward. And answer me now.
Josh, as you know, back in April, I had the opportunity to interview Exorcist director William Friedkin at a Chicago Public Library event to promote his memoir, The Friedkin Connection. In the chapter on The Exorcist, Friedkin is unequivocal when it comes to the topic of how to label The Exorcist. He does not want you to call it a horror movie.
No?
Okay. No. Keeping that in mind, as I was setting up a question for him about The Exorcist, I acknowledge that he doesn't think of the movie as a quote-unquote horror film, but I was curious if he conceived any of the scenes with the notion of trying to scare anyone. Did that ever cross his mind that he would scare people or that he was deliberately trying to scare people? His answer, quick, to the point, not at all. He said he knew the material was disturbing, that it was based on the actual case of a possession that took place in Silver Spring, Maryland in 1949, but he was never out to frighten anyone. He was more concerned, Friedkin said, with exploring the mysteries of faith. Well, Friedkin may not have been trying to scare anyone, but he did succeed in scaring a lot of people, including me. I've long contended that The Exorcist is the scariest movie I've ever seen, still traumatized from just hearing Mercedes McCambridge's demonic voice from the living room as I was in my bedroom. My parents were watching it in the other room on TV. Over the years, Josh, I'd seen parts of The Exorcist, but could never really force myself to sit down and watch it because every time I saw poor Reagan McNeil's face, I got terrified. All I wanted to do was run upstairs and cuddle with my parents. I was so scared as a young kid.
This was all based on overhearing it from the next room.
Overhearing it, and okay. Then occasionally over the years I would see it on TV. I'd be flipping channels
here
and it would be on.
Got it.
And I'd see parts from it and it would absolutely terrify me. So when I finally sat down and watched it as an adult in its entirety, it still freaked me out. I was in my early 20s. I rewatched it in anticipation of that interview with Friedkin, and guess what? It still kind of scared me. So Josh, on the third viewing, setting up this sacred cow discussion, I can report that it never really freaked me out. I never got, this time, that visceral kind of scare where you're kind of pulling up the covers around you or you're getting chills or you have to pause the movie. Now, mind you, I did watch this film laying next to my wife, so she was there to protect me. I wasn't down in the basement alone.
Good idea.
Might have been a different experience, but I never had that kind of freak out moment watching it this third time that I had as a child or a really lame adult, where you just respond to the voice, the eyes, everything about poor Reagan's face and her behavior. I'm curious, Josh, how much The Exorcist scared you when you saw it originally, and whether it scared you this time, but more importantly, how much do you think being scared plays a role in your overall enjoyment of the film?
Well, we had very different viewing experiences of this movie, actually. I don't remember the very first time I saw it in its entirety. I may, as a matter of fact, have not seen it in its entirety until the re-release, which I think was about 98 or so.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly remember seeing snippets of it. It had such a reputation, even if, you know, being born after it originally came out, you were still aware of it, and it would be on TV, as you said. So certainly aware of it. I can't remember sitting down and engaging with it until I was actually an adult, and as a matter of fact, pretty much working as a critic as well. So that's how I first came upon it. And, you know, this question of did it scare me, in a sense, it's the most fair question to ask of a horror movie. And, you know, Friedkin can call it what he wants. He made it. But in my mind, it's a horror movie. It's at once the most fair question to ask of a horror movie and the most unfair question, because it's so personal, right? The sort of things that's going to scare one person will not scare another. That is no measure at all of the artfulness of a movie, mm-hmm. at least to that degree. But on another level, it's the most fair, because scares that are just out to scare, and that's why that's such an interesting question you pose to him, those can in many ways be easy.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have a problem with The Exorcist, is that it ultimately strikes me as a cheap and easy film when it comes to those scares completely. And this was my initial impression of it when I saw it. And it was even furthered this second viewing that I recently gave it, second full viewing at least, in that this is a film that seems completely disconnected from anything except for wanting to shock its audience. And so for Friedkin to say that he didn't even really set out to do that, that's a huge disconnect for me from the filmmaker's point of view and goals to what I experienced, at least as a viewer. And the moments here that everyone remembers, the reason it got those reactions, the reason it has the reputation, are its shock moments. And so the question for me when I watch a movie like this is, what is the movie most excited about? Despite what Friedkin or any of the people involved in making it might say, what do I sense in my gut? Is it the shock moments themselves, or is it the way the shock moments serve the larger story? And in a sense, this is the same question we often ask in regards to special effects or something like a soundtrack even. We got into this a little bit on a recent show about movie themes. Are these elements simply there for the sake of themselves? And if they are, in my experience, they will often take me out of the narrative. And specifically getting to The Exorcist, I think that the moments with Reagan, whether she's spewing vomit or stabbing herself or spinning her head around, those are very much at another visual and tonal volume level than anything else in the film, which I agree feels separate from a horror film, those other parts of the movie. Mm-hmm. These are also the least well-crafted moments, I would argue. They're not foreshadowed. They're jarringly staged and edited. And a very odd thing I noticed this second viewing, they're very abruptly abandoned. So we cut away from them to these expository or narrative moments on a couple of occasions. I think of the one where something awful is happening, and before that action even finishes in any way, we get this shot of the priest, Damian Karras, played by Jason Miller, jogging. Now, this happens repeatedly, so there's probably some intentionality behind
it. Yeah, no doubt.
But for me, it just set these moments so far apart from the film. And again, because of its reputation, it became the film's reason for being. And that doesn't give me much as a viewer.
Yeah, we had completely different experiences with this film over the course of me now seeing it three different times. That's not at all how I see The Exorcist. I agree that those scenes are shocking and they are jarring, but I would say that I think you're right. It's quite by design. And I think ultimately what was most interesting to me this time, as I said, Josh, that it didn't really scare me. That's not entirely true. There were aspects of it that frightened me, but you know what they are? And I think this just speaks to how we evolve or how we get older and the things that frighten us. Again, it's no longer just seeing her scary face and her eyes and those kind of things. For me, the real terrifying part of The Exorcist now was watching the mother, was watching Ellen Burstyn as Chris McNeil, the actress, dealing with her daughter and going through this scenario where she has to basically sit there and be helpless as something takes hold of her child that she cannot find an answer to.
So what's wrong with her?
We still think the temporal lobe.
Oh, what are you talking about, for Christ's sakes? Did you see her or not? She's acting like she's out of her mind, psychotic, like a split personality or...
I just think about how, as a parent, nothing could be more disturbing or troubling or scary than that. That's what really stuck out to me this time. That's what bothered me, is watching that mom in that predicament as she tried to figure this out and was willing to do anything to try to figure out what was wrong with her daughter. That was really effective.
Okay, and I agree. That is an interesting entry point for a film that certainly you would appreciate after you become a parent. But again, I think it's representative of what this movie is interested in, and it's in these sadistic elements, because even take that character, for example, what is the scene we get of her that's going to communicate this feeling of distress that she has? Because I would argue that
there's
would be a way
them.
This movie, well, think about the defining one, at least for me, when I watched it again. It's the surgery scene early on where
sure.
the doctors subject Reagan to a brain scan that involves having a needle injected into her neck during surgery. This movie is so sadistic. It not only makes us watch that scene for no real purpose, but it makes us watch the mother watch that scene. So it's doubly sadistic, and it has this sensibility of being more interested in the blood spurting out of that needle and across the surgery sheets than it really is in Burstyn's reaction or response to that. We see her freak out from behind the window because, again, that cranks it up for us. But does this movie really explore Burstyn's character at all? I found on this viewing it didn't. Part of that is because Burstyn is so hysterical in this film. There are ranges, notes of hysteria she hits almost from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found
because she's a really good actress, you mean?
No.
She is.
Notes of one emotion, which is,
no.
I think she is a very good actress. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not writing her entire career off here. But in this film, it is different notes of one emotion that just get increasingly heightened until, for me, it didn't engender any sympathy for me for her.
I think that there's no doubt if you're not on board with the film, which you clearly weren't, then you're going to see moments like that involving the trip to the doctor's office and think that Friedkin really is just trying to up the shock factor.
But
I think it's all about the reaction in that scene.
What are we shown?
I think it's all about her reaction. I think it's all about her reaction. I think, Josh, it's all about the emphasis on the horror that this girl is experiencing and us having to watch it too. And I think that one of the big strengths of this film, and I especially noticed it this time around, is that Friedkin, who got his start as a documentary filmmaker, I think there are a lot of elements to this film, and this is where it really stands out from a lot of conventional horror movies. The reason it's so scary in a way, the reason it really starts hitting you, I think, in that last half of the film, is that Friedkin takes such care in not setting up a lot of traditional frights in that first hour of the movie. It really isn't until about the hour 10-minute mark of this film that the really gross stuff that The Exorcist is known for starts. He spends that first hour and 10 minutes setting up all these storylines and these characters, the way we meet Father Karras and his relationship with his mother, Chris and her job, Chris McNeil.
Those are really good scenes,
Reagan,
between Karras and his mother.
We even meet the lieutenant or the cop, the detective, Kinderman, and probably spend more time with him than we really need to. Just crafting these relationships. Father Marin, how about that amazing opening to this film where it all takes place in Iraq and it really sets this whole tone for the fact that this evil they're dealing with is something that has gone on since the beginning of time. I love that opening, and a lesser filmmaker might have taken the studio's notes and cut that out as they wanted Friedkin to do. But I just love the fact that a lot of this is shot very matter-of-factly. If you took out, Josh, that trip to the doctor, if you took out those scenes from this movie, didn't tell someone it was part of The Exorcist and they'd never seen it before and just put it on a screen, I think you could very easily convince them that they were watching a documentary about what mental illness and trying to figure out what caused some of these problems, these unexplainable abnormalities, what that trip to the doctor would be like. This could be a document showing you that. That's what it feels like in those scenes. So I think the authenticity of that and getting that blood spurt and seeing that needle, that's crucial. Friedkin isn't someone who's just doing that to push buttons. He's doing it because it adds to the overall horror of this tale of this girl and what she's going through.
You look at that surgery scene. I mean, I didn't do this, but I bet if you go back and just give it screen time, how much screen time is emphasized on the physical gore and awfulness of what the girl is being subjected to, and the screen time to Burstyn's reaction, which is why you originally mm-hmm. brought it up as being a strong point of the film, I guarantee you very little time is spent on Burstyn because, again, it's the shock things that this movie is most interested in. But let me get to a couple things I did like, because I think you're right that the scenes with Miller as Father Karras and his mother, who is suffering from old age and the implication is mental illness herself, I think those are good. Those are really strong. And I generally do appreciate a horror film that builds in the way this movie does. It takes its time to set atmosphere. I actually think this could have used a little more of that so that it wasn't so jarring when we do get to the big scenes, how those would work a little better with the opening part. I also think, and this is why those scenes don't work for me, because they are so haphazard in a way, because Friedkin has a lot of nice camera work in the other half of this movie, you know, the more subdued half of this movie. Some great tracking shots, some good camera pans. I think of the one where there's a shot of the priest entering the church and we're up above. There's a blurry statue in the right foreground of the scene, and then he's kind of entering in the left background and he's in focus, comes down the aisle. Mm-hmm. There are just some nice touches in there. And here's where this movie is scary for me in a way that I'll give it credit for. And maybe scary isn't the right word. Maybe disturbing is the better word, because I actually would not count The Exorcist as among one of the more scary horror films. Not just because I don't like it in general, but just for the way it works. I do think that dream sequence that Father Karras has is one of the creepiest moments in the movie. It's very brief, and actually had forgotten about it until I watched it again.
His mom in the subway, right?
His mom coming out of the subway station looking kind of confused, and he's yelling at her. And there are some quick shots in there, too, of a necklace, the fighting dogs, which we see in that opening you talked about. I think also later there's a very effective insert shot that does take place in the famous bedroom where Karras comes back into the room and he sees his mother sitting there on the bed. That's the sort of psychological stuff that is so much more effective in my mind than having the girl spew vomit again or something else outrageous like that, which
Josh,
comes from a different movie.
The fact is that you may be right in saying those are the most famous aspects of The Exorcist, but that's not what I think of when I think of The Exorcist. I think of the moments you're talking about. I think of those more subdued moments. What really appeals to
me. So there's only two of them, I guess, is my point. I'm holding these out as an example of what
I... No, I think there's a ton of quiet, interesting moments like that that stand out that aren't
that
just
are disturbing
those. Yeah, I think disturbing too. I would go back even to, you want to talk about great shots, my favorite shot in the film, just a single moment of cinematography, comes in that Iraq sequence where we see Father Marin as he discovers the Pazuzu statue, and that's where we see the dogs that are being hostile off in the distance as if the statue is sort of urging them on. But there's this amazing Friedkin shot where he kind of allied space and time a little bit, and we actually see Father Marin sort of on an equal plane with the Pazuzu statue and the sun's between them.
That's a nice shot.
A lot of great shots like that. There's another great shot. You're talking about how careful he is with the camera, where Reagan is in another room as her mom is on the phone calling her father, and the way the camera tracks out of that room till eventually we're back with Reagan kind of hiding behind the door as her mom is making this really terrible phone call. And there, Ellen Burstyn's pretty hysterical and maybe didn't need to be quite so hysterical in that moment. But what really stuck out to me, especially this third time seeing it, Josh, is how big of a factor and how many times the word guilt comes up over and over again. And I think that has to do with some of the larger questions of faith that are being explored in the movie a little bit. But I also think it maybe just gets to what I ultimately do like about this film, Josh, in the way I talked about that sort of documentary style, the way I think he tampers down the horror by making it seem like you really are almost watching a movie where you're just in the kitchen with this family in Georgetown seeing how they live, but then all these horrible things start to happen and you see how everything unravels. And so one of the ways it's grounded is in this notion of guilt. It makes it seem, Josh, almost as if even though this is supernatural and we think that maybe this possession is just coming out of nowhere, Friedkin doesn't let us just chalk it up to that. There's a point, for example, where one of the doctors says to Chris, they've kind of given up. They don't really have any more tests to run. They think maybe, you know what, something else is going on here. But he does say that this sort of split personality thing that he's trying to chalk this up to, he says it starts with a conflict or a guilt. And if you go back and watch the movie, and especially that scene I mentioned where the mom's on the phone talking to the father, and we see Reagan kind of hiding in the room as clearly her parents went through some kind of split. And we see them even at one point have a conversation about that. That clearly is sort of weighing on her mind, I think, is maybe what role that she had in that and her mom's happiness and her ultimate happiness. So that's there sort of just in the background. But then think about Father Karras, how much guilt plays a factor in his life with his relationship with his mom and how he feels as if he didn't properly take care of her. At one point when we meet him early on too, Josh, he of course points out that he feels like a fraud as a priest, that he thinks he lost his faith. He feels guilty about that. And later we even find out that Reagan's guilty of a crime. She may have had something to do with someone's death. So I could go on and on, actually. There are a ton of examples of this. And I just think that what that does is it, again, sort of grounds this movie in the sense that, you know what, this didn't just come out of nowhere. This is kind of this bubbling up of resentment, this bubbling up of fear, of trauma, of guilt in people's lives that eventually manifests itself in something horrific like this.
I think Karras is a very fascinating character, actually. I don't think the movie cares a bit about Burstyn's character or Reagan at all. I just don't. I don't get that from it. But especially how Jason Miller plays him too, the undertone he brings to the performance. Mm-hmm. I think it's very good, and I think there's a lot there. That said, the whole faith thing is a bit of a red herring to me, because the movie just gives us dollops where it seems like it wants to put that out there so that we have something to kind of grasp onto and take this more seriously than a horror exploitation film that it really is. It gives us the line, Karras even says, how he's, I think I've lost my faith. I mean, how on the nose can you get it? It's a little bit like To the Wonder, a weakness of that film, where we have Javier Bardem's priest who's going through a similar thing and he keeps talking about it on the soundtrack. We don't need that. And we don't really need it here unless it was woven in a little bit more subtly. Instead, it's just kind of thrown out there as this is what the theme's going to be. And I feel like the film is a little bit, the phrase Pauline Kael used for this is that it's a shallow seriousness. And I kind of get that sense to this picture, is that it knows it's dealing with these religious elements. It uses iconography, rites, imagery for easy associations, but not really compelling implications to me.
I cast you out, unclean spirit!
Show it up your ass!
In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ! It is he who commands you! He who flung you from the heights of heaven to the depths of hell!
F*** him!
Be gone! F***
him, Karras!
F*** this creature of God! Be gone! In the name of the Father! And of the Son, and the Holy Spirit, by this sign of the Holy Cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns with the Father and the Holy Spirit. Damien!
Amen.
I think it's very compelling, not just obviously as a movie that had that immediate kind of frightened response to it, but it is a movie that over the years, as I've seen it again and again, I see different elements in it. Whether or not they have to do with faith is kind of irrelevant, Josh, for me. I see things like the guilt that comes in. I see things like this time I noticed the whole aspect where I think the movie is largely dealing with, again, this notion of the unknown and trying to, as we take control of our lives, trying to be able to come up with a scientific explanation for everything. And then you're faced with something in modern life that can't be explained, and how that then causes a conflict that can't be matched.
You know what explores that in a really interesting way? A film from this year, Beyond the Hills, actually. Mm-hmm. The Christian Mungiu film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. It does. But I guess I saw some of those elements in this movie as well. For example, the Kinderman character, he says at one point something like, probable, not for certain. You know, there's that emphasis on things being probable, but it isn't necessarily the way it absolutely happened. And she even says, the Chris McNeil character, to Father Karras at one point, tell me for a fact that she isn't possessed. Tell me for a fact that that's my daughter up there, and this is all just some made-up thing in her head. That idea is reinforced again and again, and obviously it's reinforced in those scenes with the medical professionals where they think they have some kind of obvious explanation, and they really don't. So I think ultimately, Josh, even though I do see what you're saying, I could see how someone like Pauline Kael would say there's kind of a shallow seriousness to the film. But I guess when you try to take the whole film in, and you certainly see it in those scenes with the medical professionals as they're trying to come up with their diagnoses and they think that there's some rational, sensible explanation and scientific explanation for everything that's going on. But I think that, again, just gets back, Josh, to this sense the movie has. Maybe it's not so much about religious faith in particular. I think it's a manifestation of faith where, of course, what faith is believing in something even if you don't have any evidence to back it up. And what we see in this movie is sort of a flip side of that, where we have tons of evidence to back up that there's something really wrong with this girl, but you still can't explain it. There's still a lack of faith in what's actually happening to her as you seek some kind of explanation. So I feel like the movie as a whole is this larger kind of exploration of guilt in dealing with the conflict that happens when something in their lives, in this modern age we live in where we think everything can be explained away, when something clashes with that that can't be explained. I think that's fascinating, and I'm fascinated by that watching this film in addition to being kind of horrified by it.
So let me ask you then, these threads that resonate with you, how do they work hand in hand, or better yet, how are they enriched by the shock moments that the movie is famous for? Because I don't think you can just set those aside and say, well, that's not really what the movie is about. And I can understand if you found more interesting things in the film. Yet those are the dominant elements of this movie in terms of tone and just where they're positioned in the narrative. Mm-hmm. And this is a sacred cow, so in the enduring reputation. So I'm just wondering how those work for you in concert with these other things, or are they separate in your mind?
No, I think they work because, as I said, I think they reflect a larger sense of the true horror of what is happening to Reagan. It wouldn't be enough if it was just sort of ugly and sort of disturbing. I think it really needs to be. And actually, we're going to get into this a little bit more when we talk about The Chaser here in a minute. And there is a connection, I think, between the two films a little bit. I think we need to see those kind of truly shocking things to really understand the sort of depth of depravity that's happening to her. But this also gets to the conflict, Josh, that I think is interesting. And I wonder how you kind of feel about this. You may not be aware of it at all, but there's been, for a long time, I think they've now gotten over it, but there was a conflict for a long time between Friedkin and William Peter Blatty, who, of course, wrote the book and wrote the screenplay. He was someone who was much more a man of faith and had a little bit of a crisis of faith, but went through this process and wrote the book and the screenplay and has now come out the other side of that. But he hated Friedkin because Friedkin, among other things, cut out a key scene that eventually played in the director's cut or an extended cut later. Friedkin finally decided, okay, you know what? This bothered Bill Blatty for so long. I'll go ahead and put this back in. And the scene, Josh, is a scene in the middle of the exorcism where what we get in the cut we both watched, the original theatrical cut, is just them taking a break. And they're on the stairs. And we see Max von Sydow as Father Marin and Father Karras. And they're sort of facing opposite ways. And they're just having this respite before they go back in to wrestle with this devil. In the cut Blatty really wanted, they have an exchange where pretty much Max von Sydow's character puts it right on the nose. He says, the girl is not the target of what the demon's trying to do. The girl is us, every one of us in this house. And the purpose is to make us feel vile, bestial, rotten, and corrupt, so that even if there were a God, he could not possibly love us. That was a Blatty line that, as I said, he was really attached to, because for him, that was the whole film. That's what the whole film was about. I like the lines too, but I love that Friedkin just thought, I've already shown that, and I'm going to show that. I don't need to actually put that right on the nose. That vileness, that rottenness, that corruption, that comes through in those shocking moments. And I think we didn't need a character to underline that, how that challenges the people in that house, how it challenges the viewer to question your own faith. Do you believe that something like this could really happen? I think that Friedkin was actually smart to kind of take that back a little bit and cut that out, because he shows us. And I think that's why those shocking scenes are important.
Yeah, but there's a line between where the movie goes in those scenes. And I completely agree. You don't want that spelled out in a line of dialogue. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to do the opposite. You're not making a movie then, right? You're just delivering a speech. But to the degree of vileness or whatever you want to call it that we see on screen, sometimes that can become so dominant that it loses any other implications and it becomes solely about what's being depicted. And metaphors, illusions, those sorts of things get blasted outside because the soul point becomes that awfulness in that exact moment.
Hmm. We just see this movie completely differently. That's The Exorcist. Yes, yet another sacred cow that Josh Larson is deeming not sacred at all. He is the heretic.
Have you disliked one
yet?
Here
in the room once again. I don't think so, because we've picked great movies, Josh. That's why. We've picked great movies that I liked the first time, and I continue
I don't think
to
that's
like
it.
Them. I do think that's it. Well, we want to know your thoughts. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. And if you do want to go back and check out some of our past Sacred Cow discussions where I've just been singing the gospel, The Shining, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Pulp Fiction, To Kill a Mockingbird, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and a few more, just search Sacred Cow on the website, and you will find those reviews at filmspotting.net.
We'll try to lighten the mood a bit next with the fourth installment in our Korean auteurs marathon, 2008's The Chaser, in which a pimp is on the trail of a serial killer. Believe me, it's kind of funny. Stay with us. Hey everyone, quick reminder here that Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM10.
And we got this testimonial from Lawrence Cruz in Los Angeles. He says, I heard about Squarespace through your excellent podcast a couple years ago, but only recently built my site using it. What appealed most to me as a visual storyteller was the way most of the templates give priority to the visual image. You can blow out big, beautiful color shots and not have them hemmed in by frames, etc. I took a couple of days with a photographer friend to get the two main shots I wanted to build the site around, one an urban shot in downtown LA, the other out in the desert east of LA at dawn in Joshua Tree National Park. The design I chose allows me to add new content when I have it on my projects page, which consists of a really cool scrollable panel that's semi-opaque so you can always see the big background image behind it. The effect is very visually appealing, and I've gotten a lot of kudos from folks visiting the site. There's a slight learning curve to mastering the tools, but overall it's easy enough to maintain the site, and at $8 a month, very affordable. I know I can expand the site and its capabilities if and when I want to, with e-commerce, blogging, etc. I also love that Squarespace automatically reconfigures my website pages to work well and look great on a smartphone. I definitely recommend it for screenwriters, filmmakers, and visual storytellers of all stripes. The URL, if you want to seek out Lawrence's site, is lawrencecruzwriter.com. That's a great, great testimonial, and we will put a link to that in the notes for the show at filmspotting.net. We love featuring your sites here during these segments. If you do have a Squarespace-powered website you want to promote, just shoot us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
With Squarespace, you can easily embed videos and trailers of your favorite TV shows and films via the simple YouTube and Vimeo integration. They also have events collections, so you can keep track of TV premieres and movie releases with a Squarespace calendar feature. You don't need to have a credit card to start a trial. Just begin building your own website. And when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM10 to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. We thank Squarespace for their support. Squarespace has everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Car, 어디서 찾았어?
망원동.
경찰에 신고했어?
덜 왔냐? 잡아 죽일려는데 신고하게?
걔들 도망간 거 아니라니까? 오빠 형사했다며. 그럼 가서 애들이나 좀 찾아봐. 여기저기 돈이나 뜯지 말고.
아, 야, 미친잖아. 누가 돈을 뜯는데? 씨발 사방팔을 뜯기고 있구만.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That's a scene from the fourth movie in our Korean auteurs marathon, 2008's The Chaser, directed by Na Hong-jin. It was his directorial debut. And Josh, lest we think no one out there is following along with this Korean auteurs marathon, we did just today get this email from Blake in Yorkville, Illinois.
It's not the first, is it?
It's not the first.
Okay,
no,
good.
But it's the first one we got in response to The Chaser. And he says, I just finished watching The Chaser on my 15-inch wide laptop screen, and I honestly think that it was a more intense and nerve-wracking experience than seeing Gravity on the big screen. Yeah, I said it. Those fight scenes had me jumping and weaving, similarly to the way you said you felt in Gravity. Obviously, in terms of sheer awe, Gravity would take the cake, but story-wise, I think I enjoyed The Chaser far more, and Blake gives some reasons why. He finishes up by saying, this was the first of the Korean auteur's marathon movies that I was able to catch, and man, am I glad I did. I'll definitely be on board for the rest of the films.
Nice. We got a couple left, right?
Exactly. And I enjoyed that email because obviously he enjoyed the film and is now going to be following along. But it did strike me that this movie is probably not actually representative at all of our marathon, at least up to now. The previous three films, Three Iron, Woman on the Beach, and I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay, don't really fit into any one particular genre. But The Chaser clearly does. It's a thriller. More specifically, it's a serial killer thriller about a dirty cop turned pimp. His name's Jung Ho, who discovers that the reason a couple of his prostitutes have gone missing isn't because they ran off with the advances he paid them or were sold by another unscrupulous predatory male. They were very likely murdered by a young man named Young Min, who's playing games with the police while Jung Ho desperately searches for one of his girls, Mi Jin, who was last seen with the killer. And very well could still be alive if only they could find where he lives. There are also some peripheral political elements involving the police and the mayor and a subplot with Mi Jin's daughter. But Josh, were you like Blake? Did you find The Chaser to be intense and nerve-wracking? And did you enjoy being back on more familiar generic ground? Or are you hoping to get back to the more esoteric Korean cinema we've seen up to this point?
So the irony is that this movie isn't generic at all. I mean, that plot description, you're right. That sounds like something that could be lifted from any Hollywood serial killer thriller. But this thing is so nimble and it goes in so many directions that you don't expect. Even though all those things you described do happen, they never happen when you think they're going to happen from your training watching these movies from Hollywood. And they never happen how you think they're going to happen. I mean, there are a lot of foot chases in this picture, really well done foot chases. I can't believe this was his directorial debut. It's so assured. And the pacing of the film mirrors those foot chases. It's darting about here and there, stopping to pause for a lengthy sequence where you wouldn't expect the movie to pause, but offers some really rich rewards and sometimes comic rewards, actually. The first part of this film, some pieces play a little bit like comedy. And we could talk a little bit more about how well we think it balances this array of tones that it tries to go for. But yeah, I really did enjoy this film quite a bit, surprisingly so, actually. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm with Blake and with you. It's intense. It's nerve-wracking. It's a lot of fun, even as it's often very disturbing. And there is some edge to it as well, just in the form of this scumbag pimp being the only person who seems to really genuinely want to find this woman, Mi Jin. And he wants to find her for the right reasons, I think, so she'll be safe, as opposed to finding her so he can solve a case and earn some political points.
Well,
it doesn't start out that way.
It starts as a business decision.
Exactly.
Which is
it's all business,
what's
but
grimly
that,
amusing. And
yeah,
you're right. Then he transitioned, and that's part of the change the story takes.
Exactly. You see the chase, how it bit by bit takes its toll on his conscience. And Na, the director, he constantly shows you how easy it is to disregard some harm you cause, to avoid taking responsibility until it's literally staring you in the face and you can't look away. We see that constantly in these close-ups with our lead character here. Eventually, he does have this crisis of conscience, but the movie never really does get bogged down in that. It doesn't get overly sentimental or overly moral at all. It's still a pretty dark, cynical movie, but I think the cumulative effect of these new discoveries, these new interactions he has with people, they lead to some character epiphanies here. But this is a bad guy who doesn't think he's a bad guy at all until he just can't avoid it anymore. The evidence is staring him right in the face.
It's completely a tale of moral awakening, yet not nearly as heavy-handed as that phrase might imply. I mean, at the end, here is a guy who realizes that this killer is simply a darker version of himself, right? Mm-hmm. He's this hideous version of the way
women.
He's
yeah.
exploited women for his own means. And that just comes along slowly, horribly. It dawns upon him instead of gets preached at him.
Right.
And that's how the movie works. But what's interesting about the beginning, and I think Kim Yun-seok as the pimp gives a very layered performance here, because it's almost a comedy, and he has a comedian's look. He's got the tousled hair.
Yeah.
He's got a round face, you know, kind
he's
of a,
like an
a friendly
star.
Face almost, you know, for a pimp. He's got this friendly face, yet there are these moments of real violence where he inflicts violence on people. And early on, we see him. The movie goes back and forth. There's comedy in that he has these employees, quote unquote employees, calling in sick. So he's just a small businessman with all of these hassles. And they play that up for slight laughs. But then the movie quickly cuts not too long after he takes this call of I'm sick, I can't go out, from one of his prostitutes, Mi Jin, played by Seo Young Hee. And at first it's comic, but then when we see her for the first time, she's like pale and sweating.
Yeah, she's really sick.
Really sick. And she's got this kid at home. And all of a sudden we're in the realm of a tragedy,
mm-hmm.
in essence, real drama there. And if I have any hesitation about this movie at all, it's that I think it does everything it's trying to do independently well. The comedy works really well, and it's subtle comedy. It's not broad. This drama that I just mentioned, that's done really well. And the serial killer stuff is terrifying and intense. I mean, it's a really well-crafted movie in that sense. I don't know about how it jumps from one to the other. I did find that just a little bit jarring. I don't know if there's any way, if you're going to juggle all of this, you can bring them all together. And I was glad that it did each one independently well, but I did find the back and forth a little jarring.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the fourth film in our Korean auteurs marathon. It's a thriller from 2008 called The Chaser. I touched on those kind of epiphanies the character has along the way. They don't feel like these grand epiphanies, but are crucial moments. One of those scenes is when he goes to visit, I think it's the sister of the killer. So it's like the sister and the brother-in-law.
Yeah.
And he's talking to them in their living room, and he's really kind of treating them like he treats everyone, kind of like dirt. You know, he's really being forceful and gruff with them and assuming that they can't be trusted and they're keeping information from him. And then their son comes out. They have a boy who steps out of his room, and he clearly has some developmental issues, and he urinates on the ground. And then he learns, our main character, that the boy was attacked by his uncle, who was the serial killer. And that point isn't so much what's important as the look on Jung-ho's face when he realizes that these are people just trying to get by. They're really just trying to get by just like he is, and they're taking care of a really difficult kid, and they didn't ask for this, and they don't deserve to be treated the way he's treating them. But it takes that kid stepping out to sort of jar him and make him realize that he's mistreating people.
Well, it reframes the idea of victim in his mind, right? Because
exactly.
He is victimizing people every day of his life in his business, but he doesn't see them as he doesn't even see them as people.
No, exactly.
He sees them as business props. But when he sees this little kid who is also a victim and closely tied to the woman that he's trying to find who's mm-hmm. a victim, it puts them together in his mind, and that's where some of that awakening starts.
Yeah, and I think that some people could take issue with this movie in the sense that it has to go that far to make its point, where it's not just a kid. It's not enough that it's just a son that they're taking care of, but a kid with those issues, with this big scar and clearly has a lot of problems. But I do think, Josh, that is kind of maybe the point of the film, is that maybe the director, Na Hong-jin, is trying to give us such a dark, cynical world that he's saying the only way some people who live in this world can be shocked from their slumber to be better people is to have that kind of jolt. They need something like that staring them in the face. That's what it takes to wake this guy up anyway. This is a guy who Mi Jin labels in her phone. Remember, she calls him filth. That's how she labels him. And he hears that at one point and doesn't really understand, but I think is more surprised to hear it. Like, wait a second, is that what she calls me? I think it does register with him a little bit. He has no sense, again, that he's this terrible person until some of these things start to happen. And like I said, maybe the movie goes a little bit too far being shocking or being exploitative, but I feel like it's so clearly there deliberately that that's the point the director is trying to make, that ultimately for some people living in this terrible world, it takes those kind of moments.
There's another element to the shocking stuff, too, that I think does work. And there's a reason so much blood is involved. This is a very visceral film. I mean, there are a lot of details that are emphasized that we don't really need. You see characters brushing their teeth. There's a scene of a guy picking his toenail.
Right.
You have Mee Jin being sick. And then there's, of course, that subplot with a politician you mentioned who has feces thrown on him. And so it is this recurring theme of just this visceral, unsettling nature to this picture that the blood is clearly a part of.
Yeah. And I think it gets back to as well when you brought up the foot chases, right? These aren't these big, necessarily, action set pieces we'd be used to seeing in a Hollywood film. These are normal people. These are people who are running after each other.
They stumble on each other.
And they they take a break.
Yes.
They actually take a break. Think about how many times in an action movie you see people like they seem to have some superhuman ability. They're not superheroes, and yet they can run forever because they're chasing.
These chases are so well
done.
These
people actually just stop because they need to take a break. And, well, that's what most of us normal human beings would do. So those kind of things ground it, just like those moments do of people brushing their teeth and anything else that just constantly reframes everything that's happening to say, you know what, this may seem like a serial killer movie and you have certain expectations to it, but I'm going to try to bring this back to reality at all times. I think the movie really does a good job with that. And in the end, even as we're saying, there are these epiphanies and the character kind of comes around. What I love about it is that in the end, as troubling as it is, without spoiling too much, I'll just say, it clearly doesn't push the morality too far, Josh, because it's not as if he becomes the greatest guy on earth and he's totally reborn, or that the ending isn't still really bleak.
Yeah.
This is a movie that is still ultimately challenging in the way everything plays out. And I think it's probably frustrating for a lot of people. It was frustrating for me to watch everything played out, but frustrating in a good way. And I like that it really doesn't ever go too far as well, Josh, in trying to explain the serial killer. Yes, there are some moments given to the police. They think they've got the obvious explanation for so many guys like this who like to hurt women, but it doesn't come through that that's necessarily correct. And then later, there's another sort of explanation suggested that has to do with his work and some religious elements come in, but the movie could have so easily suggested that he's just some kind of religious fanatic who enjoys punishing women as some kind of medieval form of torture or something. The movie doesn't really do that, though.
I think it probably puts most of its chips in the corner of the sexual reasoning, though. But the reason I was okay with it leaning on that is because the interrogation scene where they emphasize that is so terrifying.
It is.
Where the two, I mean, how do you make an interrogation scene any more really tense? I mean, they're so cliched, but Na Hong-jin finds a way to do it.
That is the fourth film, again, in our Korean auteurs marathon. The Chaser, obviously one we recommend, one that is still currently available on Netflix Instant if you want to catch up with it. The fifth film in our six-movie marathon, 2007 Secret Sunshine from director Lee Chang-dong, is coming up on our next show.
We're not done with the scary stuff just yet. Up next, we revisit our top five terrifying characters lists from last year with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. It's chainsaws and Skeksis and body snatchers. Oh my.
Spotting Original Recipe listeners, this is Allison Wilmore, and this week Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit becomes Film Spotting Screaming Video Unit, as just in time for Halloween and the new big screen remake by Kimberly Pierce, Matt Singer and I review the original Carrie, directed by Brian De Palma.
Inspired by Carrie, we'll also recommend some other movies based on the work of Stephen King. It'll be spooktacular fun for boys and ghouls of all ages to listen or subscribe to the show. You can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar with Josh Larson. That's music, of course, from Bernard Herrmann's memorable score to Psycho. Psycho's Norman Bates did make our Halloween 2012 Scariest Characters Top 5, a list we revisit this week. Bates is joined by a few other usual horror movie suspects, but also by several picks that reflect our own quirky fears, unsettling characters in films by David Lynch, Orson Welles, and, of course, Jim Henson. We start the top 5 by explaining what the list is not. With help from the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips, it's our top 5 terrifying characters. Enjoy and happy Halloween.
If the rule you followed brought you to this, of what use was the rule?
Do you have any idea how crazy you are?
You mean the nature of this conversation?
I mean the nature of you. You could have the money, Anton.
That's Javier Bardem as Anton Chigurh and Woody Harrelson as Carson McKee, I believe his name is, in that great scene from the Coen Brothers film No Country for Old Men. And that leads us nicely into the Film Spotting Top 5 this week, terrifying movie characters in honor of Halloween. Specifically, we wanted to play that clip, Josh, of Anton Chigurh because he's a character I think a lot of us would agree is very scary. I certainly wouldn't want to run into him in my real life. But with this list, I know we deliberately tried to avoid characters like Anton Chigurh because he's a certain type of movie character that there are a lot of, and maybe we'll do someday here on the show in a top five, which is people who are just really violent and really crazy, basically sociopaths. So we tried to avoid that a little bit. I have a couple other things I sought with my list. What about you, Josh?
For me, it was instinctive, really emotional, and very personal. I think these are going to be interesting because what scares me might not scare either of you guys. And I also figured out that it was very much tied to things I saw as a kid and I still haven't recovered from. Every character on my list is that way, but two for sure I first encountered as a young, impressionable child.
Yeah, I think that applies to many of my picks as well. For me, it was also about not just picking characters who disgust you or kind of repulse you, not what I'd call everyday monsters. We saw some people on our Facebook page that posted people like Chad, Aaron Eckhart's character from In the Company of Men. Yes, I could see the argument that he's a monster, but I'm not sure he provokes that visceral reaction of fear that I was going for with my list. And the question I asked myself as I was forming my list was, if my wife wasn't there and I had to watch this movie on my couch in my basement all by myself, could I watch these films? Could I make it through seeing these characters? So that was my litmus test. Michael, how did you form your list and what's your number five?
I like that litmus test about the basement. You know, how would I feel about watching this alone in the basement? But I tended not to go for people with knives, you know, guns, although with one major exception, but it's really just more about characters that unsettle you, you know, mm-hmm. and you do feel like would be unusually uncomfortable real life company.
Yeah.
You know, so and at the same time, I didn't want anybody I worked with at the Tribune. So, you know, they were off the list.
I also excluded Tribune personnel.
So. Good. Well, my number five is the psychiatrist or psychologist played by Leonard Nimoy in the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I love it. To me, that's one of the slyest examples of somebody who's basically trying to suck the soul right out of you by a lot of soothing psychobabble and kind of comforting, feel-good, if it feels right, do it therapy. It's a wonderful, it's a really funny critique of the kind of new age nonsense that was really fermenting in the Bay Area in the late 70s when Philip Kaufman directed this great remake of Body Snatchers. And it's a minor character in this film, but it has always stuck with me. And I have to thank my colleague Christopher Borelli at the Tribune because he's the one who jogged my memory on it. So.
Sounds like a great pick. Unfortunately, I've only seen the original. So
what the hell?
I'm
you
sorry.
With that and Barry Lyndon over here with Josh?
I've seen it. I can't even remember him being in it, though.
Well, those terrifying turtlenecks, for one thing. He's never seen without a really the worst turtleneck they're the worst turtlenecks ever.
Josh, you're number five.
I went with Sadako and Ringu. I'm going to go with the 1998 Hideo Nakata original.
You're going Japanese here,
I'm
not
going
the
Japanese, not the Hollywood Ring films with Naomi Watts. The whole series revolves around a bizarre videotape that puts a lethal curse on those who watch it. Sadako in the original is played by, and I'm sure I'm getting this wrong, Rie Ino. I don't want to give too much away about who she is or what role she plays in the story. And it really, for me, doesn't even matter in terms of the scariness factor. It's all about the look here, the visuals.
Yeah.
She's got the long white robe, the black hair, super long, draped over her face. It's almost this, with just the black and white, it's like this binary, stark figure that just jumps right out at you. And in the cursed video, this is the image that always comes to mind when I think about her. In the cursed video, she comes out of a well in the forest slowly and kind of lurching.
That is really effective.
We got to get the lights on.
Oh, man.
It's not bright enough in here.
For some reason, though, it's ultimately the stillness of this character that haunts me, and the way she's often just standing there so that all you can do is let the dread sort of soak in on you. I think stillness is a technique that for some reason really terrifies me in horror movies. I'll get back to stillness more in my list later.
I think I may get to a pick that involves a lot of stillness as well. That's a great one. And to invert Michael's choice with Body Snatchers, this is a case where I haven't seen the original and only seen the remake, and Samara from The Ring was an honorable mention for me, mainly because of that well scene. So great pick. My number five is a movie that, Michael, you unfavorably compared the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men to, and it's maybe the film that I'd be safest to watch by myself alone in the basement because it's really more of a crime thriller than a horror movie. The character is Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs. The end scene with Jodie Foster and the night vision goggles, that would make me jump up and pop a light or two on. Certainly, that is legitimately scary. But really, with that character, what it is, it's the way Demme and Anthony Hopkins and the writer Ted Talley just do such a good job of making him a threat, a constant threat. Even when he's behind bars, even when he's in a glass cage, you don't feel safe talking to him or even watching him.
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Certainly.
Closer, please. Closer.
So I would just be trying to avoid moving anywhere close to that cell. I'd keep at least a 50-yard distance. And I guess thinking about it, what is so scary about him, I guess it's largely that he may eat you. I have to confess that disturbs me and scares me a little bit.
There's the eating factor.
It's not just that he'll kill you or hurt you, but he's slowly going to eat you. You're going to suffer, and it's all very unnatural. So that is why Hannibal Lecter is my number five.
I might have to go with Buffalo Bill, though, actually.
There's
something about the charming factor of Lecter that makes you feel, and I know it's all part of the plot, makes you feel comfortable, but that kind of remains for me, whereas Buffalo Bill is just this wild card I want nothing to do with.
Yeah, Lecter scares me more, and I know some people will probably write in and mention Francis Dolaride from Red Dragon, another character in the Hannibal Lecter series, but for me, it's Lecter. Michael, you're number four.
My number four, I find more frightening than that character. I mean, I knew it was just a matter of statistical odds that somebody would pick Lecter, Hopkins' performance as Lecter. It's a performance in a film that really did put the whammy on a lot of people. I think Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, to me, could really clean that guy's clock. And, I mean, even without the mysterious unnamed gas he's ingesting in some of the scenes in Blue Velvet, I think what Hopper does in that, when I think back to what the impact it had on me back in 86, I think, 1986, that kind of humor and horror fine line is something that actually Hopkins was treading a bit in Silence of the Lambs a few years later, and you almost get that, you get whiffs of that in something as recent as Heath Ledger's Joker in the by far the best of the three Dark Knight films. It's not easy to scare the hell out of an audience while getting the right kind of laugh, and that's what some of the most heinous behavior, well, not all of it, because a lot of it's just genuinely horrifying and painful to watch, but what Hopper's doing in Blue Velvet to me is true terror.
Hey, you want to go for a ride?
No, thanks.
No, thanks. What does that mean?
I don't want to go.
Go where?
For a ride.
A ride. Now, that's a good idea. Okay, let's go. Let's go. Get your f***ing robe. Raymond, come on. We're going to go for a joyride.
Joyride.
he's so good, and that's such a great film. It's actually in the Film Spotting Pantheon, so I couldn't include Frank Booth, but I will mention that
Could you put it in the Parthenon instead?
I could try to do that instead. Okay. I don't know if that would make a whole lot of sense, but going back to 2006, the Halloween edition of Film Spotting, then we did our top five scariest moments, scariest scenes in films, and my number five was a scene from Blue Velvet and Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth, because there is one moment in particular. It's the staircase scene where he just looks up. All he has to do is look up at Kyle MacLachlan, and that's enough to give me chills. So I'm with you on Frank Booth. Josh, you're number four.
My number four is going to come from a film that maybe not a lot of people remember, but those who do, it will definitely have had an impact on, and I think they'll agree with me here, that the Skeksis in The Dark Crystal are terrifying characters. This 1982 family creature feature is The Muppets by way of Brothers Grimm. Jim Henson really took his Muppet artistry to an entirely new and darker level here. There isn't a human face to be found in the film. Now, the heroes are forest creatures called Gelflings, and they are almost human-like, but it's the villains, the Skeksis, who dominated my imagination when I first saw the film. They're kind of a bird-like race. They look like these giant, decrepit vultures. And in the story, they're dying, and they need this crystal shard to restore their vitality. So there's a lot of these creatures, and I'm going to have to pick the creepiest one. For me, it's the one known as the Chamberlain. He's this weaselly, conniving figure, and he has this odd and insinuating whine that he does throughout the film. At one point, the other Skeksis tear the Chamberlain's elaborate robe off of him, and he's revealed to be this kind of bony, scrawny thing. He's about a third of the size that you would expect, judging by this big robe that he wears. And as a kid, it reminded me of those times I'd come across a dead bird that was kind of all bent and splayed out, except in this case, the bird still moves and talks. So when you're 8 or 9, Skeksis nightmares are no fun.
It's funny because The Dark Crystal is a movie I remember seeing in the theater when I was about 8 or 9, and you mentioned capturing your imagination. It didn't capture my imagination at all. I have no recollection of it.
And I've never seen it.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's too
bad. You have a little bit of a different appreciation for creatures that are
all things Muppets, perhaps.
Muppets, basically. You do appreciate that more than I do. My number four terrifying movie character is going to continue a little bit of a trend here. I started with my Hannibal Lecter pick. I guess you're getting an insight into my psyche. It's Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original film.
I'm going with
one of the classic horror movie villains. Faces, a lot of times in movies, in horror movies, are what terrify me. Just a face. And it doesn't even have to be a face that has a mask or anything really crazy about it. It can just be a look on a face. But with this character, Leatherface, even if I didn't know what his mask was made out of, I'd be scared just because there's something so ugly and repugnant about it. But then when you find out that it's made of human skin and he's a character who murders people and eats them, that, again, is something that just seems to really unnerve me.
I am sensing a theme here.
Yeah, that really bugs me. I don't want to be lunch. I guess I don't want to be lunch. I don't know how to phrase it any other way.
You want to eat the lunch.
His introduction scene, too, speaking of scariest movie moments, the scene where we meet Leatherface for the first time. He opens the door and drags that girl in and hangs her on the hook. That is really, really terrifying.
Hideous, yeah.
And at that point, we haven't even met the rest of the family. So we only go up from there. Leatherface is my number four. That brings us to our number three terrifying movie characters. Michael?
I love Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, which is not a horror film, and it's not a conventional thriller, but it's full of completely unsettling, wormy, eccentric. Oh, yeah.
And the character is Charlton Heston's accent. That's your number three.
The character is just the way Charlton Heston keeps saying Susie. You know, he is not the most horrifying element of that. I actually think the most memorable supporting character, side character in that film, which is really just all great side characters, is Dennis Weaver's night hotel manager.
Huh.
It's a great, amazing. There's one shot in there, and largely this is just a testament to Welles's camera sense. And I mean, where the wind is howling, and this poor schlep is out there, hopelessly outmatched by this sadistic gang of biker thugs that's kidnapped Janet Leigh, and you know, you're just imagining the worst of what's going on. And this is 1958, so this is a wonderful period where they couldn't show everything yet, and you wouldn't want to see anymore because your mind is sort of racing with all these horrible possibilities. But Dennis Weaver is again sort of this pathetically funny figure who's just kind of standing up there like King Lear's fool in this howling wind, just hopelessly. I'm just a night man. And somehow that kind of desperation to me is more frightening than anything in a conventional horror film. So Dennis Weaver, ladies and gentlemen.
An inspired pick there, Michael. Josh, you're number three.
I'm going to go back to my childhood, and this would be the clown in Poltergeist.
I wondered if someone would bring it up. That's a scary scene.
Clowns are scary enough, right? And then Poltergeist has to go and up the ante. This is also from 1982, same year as The Dark Crystal, interestingly enough.
What happened in 1982 to you, Josh?
Let's investigate.
Rough year
on the next film
spot. There are so many things wrong with this bedtime scene. It's where Robbie is going to bed with his sister next to him, which should provide some comfort, but for some reason it
wouldn't
doesn't.
For me.
They've got the toys scattered about. And the one thing I wonder is, why is this clown doll so big? It's like between the size of a regular doll and a small person.
So it's scary, Josh. So it's scary.
Yeah, but why do that? And the other thing, why is it placed in the chair? So it's sitting at the foot of his bed, looking directly at him.
Who would do that?
Does that?
It's like the only thing missing in that bedroom is the dummy that Anthony Hopkins was using in the movie Magic.
Right.
The ventriloquist dummy.
Oh, I remember being terrified by that Saturday morning cartoon, that commercial, I should say. I saw that. I remember that. It was horrifying for Magic.
Well, I love the touch in Poltergeist where Robbie tries to throw the blanket over the clown from bed, and it hits those jingling bells, which become notes of terror. And then he misses with the blanket, but of course he doesn't get out of the bed because he's not leaving that bed for anything. And the attack itself, of course, is terrifying precisely because the clown drags him where? Under the bed. The only thing that saves me from cardiac arrest is the clown's arms. How they kind of get longer and wrap up. I always found that to be a little silly. And
it's cartoonish.
I could take a breath there and let it go.
That's a great pick. And it gives me a chance to mention one of my honorable mentions from a horrible film. Really not a good movie at all, but the character obviously very memorable. It's Poltergeist 2 and the character of Kane, the older man in the black suit who comes to their door.
I don't remember him.
I've never seen the sequel.
It's really not worth seeing, but just do a Google search. YouTube Kane and Poltergeist 2. It doesn't matter if it's daylight or not. You'll get scared. I'm telling you right now. It's actually an honorable mention for me. My number three goes back to what we've spent most of this show discussing, The Shining, and it is the Grady twins. Though, actually, in the film, if you remember Ullman's line of dialogue, they're not really supposed to be twins. They're
8
years old and 10. Exactly,
and 10.
Michael. But they're played by twins in real life, and most people do refer to them as the Grady twins. So that's what I'm going with as well. If you take out the music, this is something I was very aware of as I watched the film this time, that score by Wendy Carlos and Rachel Elkin, if you took that out, I don't know how scary The Shining would be, because the music anticipates a lot of the big fright moments in the movie. But Danny coming around that corner on his big wheel, the classic shot from The Shining, probably the most classic shot anyway, and seeing those twins with the music, that really gets my heart racing. And I think it's obviously the surprise factor, partly. Every time you see them, it's a surprise that they just appear. And this gets back to your stillness line there, Josh, because they are so still. If you just take them at face value, there's nothing really scary about two twins in dresses. They look a little weird, maybe, but otherwise they're just standing there. It's something about the combination of the music and the look on Danny's face and the close-ups and just the heightened tension of that moment. Actually, what Kubrick does in that scene in the hallway is he cuts to Danny and then he keeps cutting back to them, and every time he cuts back he's closer to them. Mm-hmm. And that really gets the tension mounted there in that scene. Right away, the Grady twins popped into my head when I thought about terrifying movie characters. Had to make my list. Michael, you're number two.
That's a good one. This is not anybody's idea of a major movie character, but I love my number two is the movie projectionist and movie buff Bob Vaughn, played by Charles Fleischer in David Fincher's film Zodiac.
Wow.
Remember the scene?
I do. How could you forget?
Jake Gyllenhaal's visiting this guy, trying to get this this whole thing about. He holds the clue to the 1932 film, The Most Dangerous Game, and this somehow will help fill in this piece of the puzzle that never quite gets solved, which is the genius of the film. And the whole scene, A, it's one of the best sequences Fincher's ever staged, but Fleischer's the kind of way he's photographed, and the whole thing is just shot through with horrible dread and just imminent danger that never quite gets fulfilled, but it's really kind of a great little portrait in this movie obsessive, and it to me it's like a cautionary tale in that this is what you turn into if you become a little bit too much of a movie buff. And this is Fleischer's portrait of this guy who just clearly all he lives for is what he can collect in his basement. And Gyllenhaal, who I don't think is really frankly much of an actor, is acting straight from his gut in this scene because everything else about the scene is just terrifically effective. And I love it. It's a great little cameo.
I thought at first when you were going with film projectionists, you were maybe thinking of Mark Lewis and Peeping Tom.
That's what I thought too.
Alan Pressburger, who's also pretty scary, and that's a scary movie, but I'm going to confirm everything you're saying about that scene. My top five scariest scenes, that scene in Zodiac was my number two. I'm right there with you.
It's the defining scene for Zodiac. Easily its most terrifying. My number two is Count Orlok. I'm going all the way back to Nosferatu. How many movie vampires have we had? I mean, far too many, probably. Yet none of them have ever looked like Max Schreck in F.W. Murnau's 1922 silent take on the Dracula legend. He's got the bald head, which emphasizes the paleness, this unearthly paleness, the wild eyebrows and the pointy ears, the elongated fingers and nails. This is hardly the dashing Count Dracula that we often get. He's far more creaturely. He's almost alien-like, really. And the stillness comes into play with Orlok again. Even when he's moving, his arms kind of hang straight down to his sides, and he slowly walks forward without using them at all and just emphasizes them as weapons, perhaps. I don't know. Something about that just disturbs me. This really was a high point of German expressionism, and you think of the iconic image of Orlok coming up the stairs, that shadow. I mean, shadows are used so beautifully throughout this film. Now, you'd think an old movie like this couldn't frighten, say, yeah, you're not really scared of that movie, are you? But when I think of that face and that image, it gives you that chill. And there's something about the unique aura of the movie that adds to its power, because it's unlike anything we get now or have gotten for a long time. Somehow that makes it scarier.
I'm with you. In fact, vampires often scare me in movies, though I didn't pick one for this list. But Nosferatu the Vampire, the Herzog film with Klaus Kinski, is one I definitely considered, because Kinski on his own is terrifying. But then you put him in that vampire makeup and give him those eyes, and that's enough to really scare me. So great pick. My number two is a character who, kind of like the twins in The Shining, is menacing and very frightening, but doesn't really have anything that makes him scary in a conventional kind of way. He's not like Leatherface or Jason. He's just a guy with long salt and pepper hair who makes kind of goofy faces, but he scares the hell out of me. And it's Bob from Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, the David Lynch film that came after the series, but is more like a prequel or sets up the Twin Peaks series that was on ABC. I don't know what it is about him that scares me so much. It's, I guess, the way he appears hiding behind things all the time. He's in Laura's room. In the TV series, he's hiding behind a couch. And it gives you the sense that he could be lurking in your room, hiding in a corner, or he could be behind the couch in your living room, all of a sudden appearing. And actually, when I was in college, my sophomore year, my roommate, Kevin, we had bunk beds, you know, college standard dorm. When we were going to bed, I'd get in bed first. And then before he got in his top bunk, he would often perch just over the couch in a Bob position. And he would wait for me to notice that something was off in the room and open my eyes and see him basically right above me in a Bob pose waiting to scare the hell out of me. He thought that was fun, and it was it was not fun.
Where's his radio show?
He's an actor, as you might imagine, and a fine drama professor now. But actually, I think too with Bob, it's just something about what he does embody. If you watch the series, if you watch the Fire Walk With Me film, he is in some ways this character who seems to embody evil. That he's someone that you welcome in with all your weaknesses and all your frailties. You could end up being possessed by Bob. And that's not a place you want to be. So that's my number two. That brings us to our number one most terrifying movie character, Michael.
Lucille Ball in Mame. No.
Yikes.
No, just not quite. I try to avoid a really famous example for this number one slot, but I in the end, I had to go with Norman Bates, as played by Anthony Perkins in Psycho, because of all it has wrought in its wake, all these cheap imitators and, you know, much less creative and inventively imagined serial killers since. And I guess Norman, yeah, I mean, Norman Bates is a serial killer, and so therefore he's a relatively early, 1960, not so early in film history, but a relatively early major in the real shock era of cinema. That's an early example of a movie that just was notorious at the time, and people thought it was cheap and offensive and it went too far, and how could even a guy like Hitchcock with a reputation put out something like that? Well, this is a film like Kubrick's The Shining, that the reputation has just grown every decade, and I find that film and that performance profoundly upsetting and unsettling. And I think the image of Norman Bates in that cell with the eyes down and that classic what would become
the
Kubrick phrase, where you have that subliminal moment of superimposition where you have the skull, the mummy, you know, kind of the skull of the dead mother, you know, smiling through, just keep smiling through. And then the dredging the car up, Marion Crane's car. That's a great last 5-10 seconds. That, I mean, everything comes together with Bernard Herrmann's final chords of the score. And his next film, Hitchcock's film that followed up, The Birds, is very scary, very frightening in another way, and has sort of, in a completely different way, has an ending that is just as tantalizing and unresolved, you know, where you just see that car full of survivors driving off very slowly because the birds have for some reason decided not to attack that time. That's poetry. I mean, that's real art. That's real art.
They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
That closing scene of Psycho is amazing. That closing shot, and the thing that amplifies it is just that twisted little smile on his face. Yep. It just somehow makes it all that more unnerving. Great pick.
Yeah, that was an honorable mention for me. Easily could have broken into the top five. For my number one, though, I'm going with a relatively recent film and a somewhat minor character in terms of screen time. It's Tomas in the Orphanage. This is a 2007 Spanish film from director Juan Antonio Bayona. It's about a woman. She's a wife and a mother who reopens the orphanage where she grew up, and she's hoping to refurbish it and bring new kids there. But then weird things start to happen. One of these is the fact that her 7-year-old son, Simon, claims to have an imaginary friend named Tomas. And he draws this friend as a child with a sack over his head. That's creepy enough. But then this baghead kid makes an actual appearance in the film. And I just about lost it when this happened. And it's not even in this real spooky, I don't want to give it away, but it's not like, you know, in a dark tunnel or something when he does appear. But when he does, yeah, it's really rough. Now, obviously, there's something about the fact that it's a kid here. And we do learn some more about Tomas that makes him more of a horrifying figure. But I'm going to go back to that silence and the stillness that is used here, because when we see him, he's just sort of standing there. I think what this technique does is it puts the ball in the audience's court, so we're being forced to respond in some way. And in these instances, all we have to offer is fear, and it certainly works here with Tomas. For months after this movie came out, and I was a grown man at this point, whenever I woke up in the middle of the night to get a drink of water or whatever, I always feared that this kid would be standing there.
Wow.
I was like Robbie in Poltergeist. I did a lot of holding it for a while.
I bet. I love that pick. And I do have to mention, to show how I'm right there with you, that top five list from episode 233 of the show, Scariest Scenes, just ahead of Zodiac, was a scene from The Orphanage.
Yeah.
That's how scary that film is for me. It's not
actually. Seance is fantastic.
That's it. I think it's the seance, not actually the one you're mentioning where we see Tomas. It's the scene near the end of the film that just destroys me.
Okay,
meet some other characters.
And the seance comes quite early, right?
Oh, okay. Then I'm thinking of a different sequence, but there's one at the end of the movie where they're playing a children's game. That's the one.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the one that kills me in the orphanage. So great pick. And I love the fact that here on our Halloween show, we've got 15 unique movie characters. There was no overlap at all. And like you, Michael, I love to try to come up with more inspired creative picks. But sometimes you just have to go with the originals, the ones that really scared you from a very young age.
And Lucille Ball and Mame.
Exactly. Yeah. Here, though, the power of Christ compels me to pick Regan McNeil / Satan as my number one
really
scariest movie character. And it's funny because I hear that tone in your voice, Michael, like she's really not that scary.
No, I don't love the film.
Oh, see, I like the film a lot.
And by the way, I'm not that crazy about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, I've heard that. Somehow
really?
I've heard
kidding
that,
me?
Actually. But I said it with Leatherface. It's something for me mostly about faces that scare me. And the eyes, the yellow eyes of Regan as she becomes possessed, that deteriorating face, her voice, the Mercedes McCambridge voice, but also her deviousness as a character. I always think of the scene where I believe she's talking to Father Marin and she starts talking like Father Marin's mom, I think, and saying these really horrible, vile things. That's really scary. I was pulling a clip today for this top five, and I got scared in broad daylight just looking at scenes and looking at Regan's face from The Exorcist. I think there's, too, something about, as ridiculous as this may sound, something about The Exorcist that really scares me just in it supposedly being based on a true story and all these real life exorcisms we hear about. There's something about that. If there's any shred of truth to stories like The Exorcist at all, then it suggests that there's a real evil in this world that I don't fundamentally buy into. But then movies like this make me question that a little bit, and that scares me.
I'm a friend of your mother's. I'd like to help you.
You might loosen the straps, huh?
I'm afraid you might hurt yourself, Regan.
I'm not Regan.
I see. Well, then let's introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karras.
And I'm the devil. Now kindly undo these straps.
If you're the devil, why not make the straps disappear?
That's much too vulgar a display of power, Karras.
Where's Regan?
In here with us.
Show me Regan and I'll loosen one of the straps.
Can you help an old altar boy, Father?
Your mother's in here with us, Karras. Would you like to leave a message? I see that she gets it.
Fittingly, we end the show where we started with William Friedkin's The Exorcist, Regan McNeil, my number one terrifying movie character from Halloween 2012. That was our top five terrifying characters. Please send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release, Ridley Scott's The Counselor, directing a script by Cormac McCarthy, Brad Pitt and Michael Fassbender star, as well as Penelope Cruz, Cameron Diaz, and Javier Bardem. And Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa. Yes, I know our producer, Sam Van Halgren, is loving this. He is all in on the Jackass movies.
I will defend Jackass the movie.
Will you?
Yeah.
But I like Jackass number two, but I didn't see number one.
Wow. What?
I didn't.
Who does that?
Well, I didn't need to. I was able to catch up somehow
that.
With Jackass number
that.
Two. Out in limited release, All Is Lost. This was my number four most anticipated movie of the fall. It's starring Robert Redford. It's directed by Margin Call's J.C. Chander. And Escape from Tomorrow is out as well. That's a fantasy horror film covertly shot at Disney theme parks. Next week here on Film Spotting, we're going to talk about the other movie starring Brad Pitt and Michael Fassbender. That's 12 Years a Slave from director Steve McQueen. Also stars Chiwetel Ejiofor. And our top five, I think right now, Josh, we're settled on movies set in the South.
Yeah,
have you started this list?
I have not started it.
I haven't either, and I know our wonderful members of the Film Spotting Advisory Board are kicking around titles. It just seems maybe a little bit too massive. Are we really going to be able to narrow down movies that are set in the South?
I'm sure there will be parameters set at some point.
Okay. Well, we'll work on that, and we will get to the fifth movie in our Korean Auteurs Marathon. It's 2007's Secret Sunshine.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.